Morning. I generally spend a minute or two, sometimes three, sometimes four, I guess, kind of making some introductory remarks on the passage, how it connects to the idea of the teaching for the morning, and how those things speak to the situation of our lives. Instead of using a lot of my own words, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm going to show you a music video. It's from the early 90s, which is, I mean, that's not the only reason we should love it, but it's Billy Joel's River of Dreams. And I want to play it because I think it's a song that speaks to the real struggle, interesting struggle, life is. Because if you notice the lyrics are anything but certain and hopeful. And so there's a real ambiguity. And yet the music is this buoyant, bountiful kind of tune. So without any further ado, here we go.
In the middle of the, I go walking 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 in the middle
I showed that to my students this week. I teach undergrads. And in philosophy class, we looked at this. And we had this kind of group experience watching it. I had it cranked pretty loud, too. But not that that wasn't loud. But I said, how did that song make you feel? And one of my students interrupted me almost at the end of the sentence. Says, I want that to be my life. And it's interesting because, a lot of us, that is our life on a good day. Like, the lyrics are a lot more ambiguous than the tune. It's kind of this Lion King in your picture, the circle of life marching triumphantly, right? And yet, it's in the middle of the night, I go walking in my sleep from the mountain of fate to the river so deep, I must be looking for something, something sacred I lost. But the river is wide and it's too hard to cross. G.K. Chesterton says that the truth for all of us is that we've all forgotten who we are. That we all have lost the sort of true, full sense of ourselves. And he says, and the problem is most of us have even forgotten that we've forgotten. And I think this sort of stuff that comes out of this song is that moment when you remember that you've forgotten who you are and whose you are. And that's where it's this freeing thing, because you're actually honest with yourself for a minute, the disorienting nature of how reality is, but then it's pretty scary too. So let's pray. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight. You, O Lord, who are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So, I want to focus on three things today that we see in this text. And they are the nature of Christ's appearances, the nature of the church's mission, and the precious power of the scars. So, those three things. There we go. Sorry, just trying to see the slides. Even though I can't control them, I can at least see them. Which brings me some comfort in this life, I suppose. Walking by faith and not by sight. So the first thing, let's look at the nature of the appearances. We read this in the text, the opening text. We have a slide there for John 21:19. Cool. On the evening of the day, the first day of the week, the doors were being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews. Jesus came and stood among them saying, "Peace be with you." Jesus comes to the community of gathered and defeated and afraid disciples. This is a community that is under the cover of darkness in the evening, maybe in the middle of the night, with that sort of sleepwalking kind of anxiety that Billy Joel describes in that song. They're probably feeling alone, afraid, guilty, and ashamed. Here was this man who'd been at the center of their lives for 3 years, who they've built real intimacy with, and who they deserted. They're locked behind closed doors for fear of the Jews. And let me just say something here. This is an anti-Semitic comment. They are Jewish. So when John says the Jews, he doesn't mean he's not making a racial comment. That's his shorthand for the religious establishment, okay, the religious authorities. Always be suspicious of religious authorities is something that the Bible gives us good credence to, at least, if not be a bumper sticker, put it on a post-it on your mirror or something. There's not always this link between revelation and religion. In fact, oftentimes, it's the religious that stand in the way of these revelatory moments, right? Because the problem with revelation is you can't control it, right? these real revelatory moments where God breaks in. And religious leaders, we like orchestration, right? We want to kind of keep everything boxed in the way it is. So oftentimes when revelation comes, the first people that it makes nervous are the religious establishment. So anytime you see a religious authority, take them with a grain of salt, including and especially. I resemble that remark, okay? Not that I'm much of an authority, but they're sitting there alone. And this was like a Billy Joel week for me. So I think I'm reconsidering the seriousness with, or lack thereof, with which I take Billy Joel as an artist. Some of it's on the Adult Contempo channel. When you get on those kind of stations, you just sort of, you know, it's not quite as artistically sophisticated as Dylan or Johnny Cash. But there's this great line in Piano Man, right? Sing us a song, you know, the Piano Man. And he says, well, they're sharing a drink they call loneliness, but it's better than drinking alone. Right? How true is that? Right? They're sharing loneliness. It's better than drinking alone. Right? So here, they're probably lonely and estranged, and yet, what do they do? What's so remarkable is they stick together. In the moments of the despair, they don't hide. I was explaining to a friend who has a counseling background a situation that happened that was pretty hard for all parties involved. And he said, well, you know, what's remarkable is no one sort of, when the lights went on, no one did the sort of cockroach thing and scuttled under the refrigerator or something, right? Usually when life bears down on us, the first thing we want to do is hide. And often hide alone. They don't do that. They stick together. And then Jesus comes in the midst of them. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, great mid-20th century German thinker and pastor and activist who was involved in the movement that stood up to Adolf Hitler, wrote this in a little book called Life Together. Let him who cannot be alone beware of community. Let him who is not in community beware of being alone. Each by itself has profound perils and pitfalls. One who wants fellowship without solitude plunges into the void of words and feelings. And the one who seeks solitude without fellowship perishes in the abyss of vanity, self-infatuation, and despair. They're sharing a drink called loneliness, but they're not doing it alone. But you can be alone in community. This is where Bonhoeffer says you have to watch both. There's sort of two kind of twin dangers that can really happen and that you've got to be aware of. You've got to be aware. If you're afraid of community, gosh, you ought to be really scared to be alone. Because if you're afraid of community, it's probably because you've been wounded in some pretty early informative relationships. And so you've sort of shut down that part of yourself. But the problem is that part of the self, you think it's shut down, but it starts doing other work on you. A lot of times our defense mechanisms become autoimmune disorders, right? You know, autoimmune diseases are diseases where actually your immune system turns against the body it's meant to protect. So sometimes, you know, with an honest defense mechanism, we sort of withdraw from a certain kind of personal relationship. But what happens is if you keep doing that, it eats away internally. But if you're afraid to be alone, you've also got to be afraid of community. If you can't ever sit with your solitude, if when you're sitting and thinking about who you really are, if you've always got to be around people because they're a distraction, if you've always got to get swept up into other people's story, and maybe you're even being really helpful when you do it, if that's all you can do, if that's the only way you can feel, if that's the only way you can exist, then you got to be afraid of community. But if you can, as a person, bring yourself to the community, one that's not afraid of yourself, but also realizes that you're not meant to be self-enclosed, that's where the revelatory stuff happens. That's where Jesus chooses to appear. And he appears in the midst of a group sharing the drink of loneliness and despair and lots of other beverages, metaphorical ones they're probably sharing. and says, peace. Peace be with you. That's where, in the restlessness, the peace can come. It's interesting that Jesus repeats this visit 8 days later. Right? 8 days later, this kind of gets rebooted. This appearance to the disciples. Now, their 8 days is saying next week. Because they're counting the first, they're counting the day as a day plus the number. So they wind up saying eight. But what they mean is, it's the next Sunday. He doesn't appear, think about that. There's this earth-shattering event. Jesus comes and speaks peace. Probably looks Peter right in the eye. I know you don't think I could be speaking a word of peace after what you've done, but I do. I do. And he not only speaks the word of peace to them, there's an embrace, there's a sharing in even his identity and mission. Then he doesn't show up for another week. Imagine what they were thinking for that week. Like, was that it? Is this just epiphenomenal experience, this one-shot deal? Is this just a freak of nature? No, no, no. He comes back one week later on the Lord's Day. I think John's telling us there's something significant to gathering as a community. A community that you wouldn't choose yourself. See, it's said that blood is thicker than water, but really the water of baptism is thicker than blood. Because really what can happen is that these people who you wouldn't choose to necessarily befriend, but who, because you're part of this community in which Jesus is in the midst, this mysterious figure, when that happens, all of a sudden you have a window into new dimensions of self-understanding, of understanding other people. You relate. See, every person that you come into contact brings out something unique in you and in you and them. And I think that what John's telling us is that there's something unique. It's not as though God's not active in the world outside of the Lord's Day, outside of these Sunday gatherings around water, word, loaf, and cup. But there's something special and unique that orients us all, that anchors us when we gather together. So here, you know what's amazing to me? What's amazing to me is that Thomas, after missing out on this experience, goes back to the fellowship. What's more alienating than maybe, like, you were going to take this vacation or something, right? And you decide you didn't have the money, or you just didn't know you could be away from home that long or something, and your friends go, and they have this kind of experience, and you feel left in the dust. You feel like the relationship you have with them is done now because they've leapt ahead. They've had this new, enlivening, shared, collective memory that you don't have. Have you ever felt boxed out in those situations? Maybe you're estranged from somebody in the family and you don't go to the family wedding, or maybe you're not invited. And there's these awkward things going as the Facebook photos go up and the stories are told, and you weren't there. And you feel like you'll never ever know those people the same way again. What must Thomas have been thinking? Often, right, our doubts and our struggles to believe things that we're told, they're not just the head. Although they're often, intellectual stuff is stuff that we ought to take seriously, but often it's in the heart. Maybe it's I can't believe. Maybe it's I don't know if I want to believe. Maybe he decides it's better to be drinking alone than share that strange drink of loneliness that those disciples went through. And yet, he goes back to the fellowship. The first thing I think that we often do if we're involved in churches or traditional kind of Christian communities or something, when we struggle, we often feel like, well, I shouldn't be in church if I'm struggling. If I have some ambiguities, I ought to wait till I have it all sorted out. No, no, that's when you go back to the fellowship. That's when it takes the most courage. But that's also where you feel the most broken. And the most vulnerable, usually. And that's usually the places where Jesus appears in the midst and says, hey, here's the peace you've been looking for. There's a So this is why it's so interesting, because we call Thomas Doubting Thomas, and I don't know why we do that, because we should just call him Believing Thomas. Because he just believes the same way the original 11 do. He finally gets to see it. It's funny, I think John is putting this in here to say, actually, these are the original apostles, the guys who got the whole thing going, they're not in any better position. Actually, you're in a better position, because he says, blessed are those who believe because they've seen. Blessed are you because you haven't seen, and yet you've believed. All of us are in that setting that Thomas was. None of us were in that original first appearance. But what he does is he shows up in the community of people who are telling and living the story. And there he sees Jesus. There's this great line, right, in the song River of Dreams about, in the middle of the night, I go walking in my sleep through the jungle of doubt to a river so deep. I know I'm searching for something so undefined that it can only be seen by the eyes of the blind in the middle of the night. That's where Thomas does. Thomas has the courage to go back to the fellowship in the middle of the night. G.K. Chesterton says this. What the Christian does, what the follower of Jesus does, is he puts the seed of dogma in a central darkness. But it branches forth in all directions with abounding natural health. As we have taken the circle as the symbol of reason and madness, we may very well take the cross as the symbol at once of mystery and of health. Buddhism is centripetal, but Christianity is centrifugal. It breaks out. For the circle is perfect and infinite in its nature, but it's fixed forever in its size. It can never be larger or smaller. But the cross, though it has in its heart a collision and a contradiction, can extend its four arms forever without altering its shape. Because it has a paradox in its center, it can grow without changing. The circle returns upon itself and is bound. The cross opens its arms to the four winds. It is a signpost for free travelers. Thomas breaks out of the circle of his own isolation and gets to the place where things can expand, where the world can get bigger, where the cross can come and the community of the cross can be the place where he hears a word of peace. Which brings us to the nature of the church's mission. In order to really receive the peace of Jesus, you've got to participate in the mission of Jesus. They come one and the same. It's not conditional. They just come one and the same. It just happens. It's like trying to separate the heat of the sun from the light of the sun. They just come inextricably bound. You can't. What happens if you really experienced it? You have to go out and tell people. Think about when you have had an aesthetic experience. I don't care what kind of, whether it's food or whether it's someone here was just telling me that yesterday they were at a cooking class at the restaurant school in Philadelphia, and she was telling me that how great the food was, and she was exuberant, right? Now, I don't really like to cook, but she couldn't hold it in. Because when you've experienced something that powerful, you just have to share it. And if you don't want to, it's because you're repressing it. Right? Whether it's a relational beauty and good, whether it's music, whether it's an idea that's so compelling, that's transformative, you have to share it. You have to share it. And what Jesus says is that as the Father has sent me, I've sent you. I send you. There's always ascending. The mission of God is never come, although there are attractional moments people will come to, but it's always go. It's always go out to the places that where people need to hear the forgiveness of sins. where people need to hear that as things have been, so they shall not always be. Things can really change in this world. Things can really be different. You can get out of depressive ruts. You can get out of dysfunctional patterns that have haunted you for decades. You can forgive yourself. You can be forgiven. You can forgive others. That really you can live in the newness of... Yeah, some of us, many of you have probably seen the film Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray is this kind of arrogant jerk, but slightly compelling in a weird way, right? Because maybe that's because I resemble too much, I don't know, something. But I find him compelling. And he just goes, he wakes up over and over again in the same day, over and over and over and over. And we don't know how long, it could be for decades. Nietzsche called this the doctrine of eternal recurrence, that things just happen over and over and over the same way. And he goes from, like, if somebody noticed that he goes through all these stages of grief, acceptance, anger, bargaining. He's trying to do anything to end the cycle. And finally, when he stops trying to end it, all of a sudden, real love, real one-way love happens. He starts really just loving people for who they are and then allows himself to be loved. And it breaks the cycle. The nature of the church's mission, this is why the resurrection makes all the difference. Yaroslav Pelagin, the great Yale historian of ideas, said that if the resurrection is true, the bodily resurrection of Jesus is true, then nothing else matters. And if the bodily resurrection of Jesus is not true, then nothing else matters. Because he's saying, if this didn't happen, if history didn't, if something like the Big Bang, some kind of unrepeatable event, didn't enter into history, then we're just a prison of the eternal recurrence. It's just literally one damned thing after the other. But if this really happened, it's a game changer. Everything is different. And that's the nature of the church's mission. And there's these twin things. It's exclusive, okay? It is exclusive. And if you're a good 21st century kind of cosmopolitan, pluralist person, this is hard, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, right? It sounds like the most arrogant thing to say, this thing is the truth you need. But it always is a truth told through vulnerability and suffering. That's why anytime there's ever coercion, anytime there's ever manipulative proselytization, that's not what Jesus is talking about. He says, as the Father has sent me, I'm sending you. In weakness, getting out of my comfort zone, allowing myself to be mocked, humiliated, and shamed, so that you could experience the transcendent power of forgiveness. I promise you, if this is your absolute, it will make you more generous than any relativistic pluralist could ever imagine being. Because this absolute is that this one suffers and dies for his enemies so that they could know peace and forgiveness. What if that's the truth you cling to? Lastly, the precious power of the scars. And this is where I think the whole, it's so interesting. The scars show up twice. When Jesus does the reboot, it's like a reloaded, it's sort of like a remix of the first video. But he has the appearance almost the same way for Thomas, and the scars are important. And Thomas says, unless I see the scars, I'm not going to believe. Because they told him about the scars. The scars, I think, are huge. G.K. Chesterton says this. Symbols alone are of an even cloudy value in speaking of this deep matter. And another symbol from physical nature will express sufficiently well the real place of mysticism before mankind. The one created thing which we cannot look at is the one thing in the light of which we look at everything. Like the sun at noonday, mysticism explains everything else by the blaze of its own victorious invisibility. Detached intellectualism is, in the exact sense of a popular phrase, all moonshine. For it is light without heat, and it is secondary light, reflected from a dead world. But the Greeks were right when they made Apollo the god both of imagination and of sanity, for he was both the patron of poetry and the patron of healing. The truth by which all men live has primarily much the position of the sun in the sky. We are conscious of it as a kind of splendid confusion. It is something both shining and shapeless, at once a blaze and a blur. But the circle of the moon is as clear and unmistakable, as recurrent and inevitable, as the circle of Euclid on a blackboard. For the moon is utterly reasonable, and the moon is the mother of lunatics, and has given to them all her name. See, the moon is borrowed light. It looks like it's got its own light, but it doesn't. It's just reflecting the light of the sun. But the sun is the thing that you can't look directly into. Your eye's not meant to, and yet it allows you to look at everything else. The church's confession is that Jesus is God, the all-powerful, the infinite, and yet he has scars. How can that be? How can you have a God with scars? That's the paradox. The paradox is the truth, the central truth, which you look into the light of, and which doesn't just give you clarity, but it gives you healing. That's where he says Apollos is both the God of imagination and healing. Because this thing which blows our minds and our imagination, that God, Jesus is fully human and fully divine, that he has scars, is where the real power is. Because here's what most of us do in these Billy Joel kind of moments where life feels so transcendent and so amazing and so full of possibility and yet so scary, so fragile, so terrifying, is we choose one or the other. We say, okay, you've got to be somebody that's idealist and say, hey, suck it up, get over the scars, put cover up on it, you know, and just go out and have a good time. Come on. How does it feel when you're really in the midst of struggle and angst and pain, and somebody says, come on, just don't think about it, let's go out? And maybe you try, but it feels so dismissive. And yet, there's a cynicism that says, hey, it's all just scars. It's all just scars. That's not satisfying either. I was watching Game of Thrones, and there's this, I haven't read the books, sorry, because some people here have, I know, and I hope that makes my witness still credible, right? And Lady Sansa, one of the daughters of the main character's family, she finds herself exiled. She was meant to be the king's wife, and yet then she winds up on the wrong side of this young king, winds up exiled. She's really depressed, and she's sitting with her handmaiden, and she's talking with her, and they're watching ships at a port. And they have this dialogue. She says, they're playing the game, like guessing game, like make up a story for the ships. She says, you know, that ship's dawn, it's going to dawn. And her handmaiden says, why is it going to dawn? And she says, well, it's carrying silk. I suppose it's carrying silk in exchange for wine. And then it'll take that wine back to the King's Landing. And she speaks cynically because this is her home she's exiled from, and yet she doesn't really like the home. And she said, the captain's tired of risking his life so King's Landing lords and ladies can get drunk on better wine than they deserve. He's going to stay in Dawn and wait out the winter where it's beautiful and warm. The woman says, I met some people in Dawn who weren't so beautiful and warm. She says, don't ruin the game. And her maiden says, I told her maiden who's had a hard life, says, I don't want to play. She ignores the maiden and says, what about that one there? And her maiden says, that one's going to Valentis. And she says, why? And she says, because I got on a ship in Valentis and it looked like that one. And the princess gets angry. She says, that's not how the game works. You're not supposed to just blurt out the right answer. You've got to invent a story about where the ship is going and why. She said, why should I invent a story when I know the truth? To which the princess replies, because the truth is always either terrible or boring. Why do we doubt? We don't doubt the pessimistic truth, right? We doubt because sometimes life gets so good, like that boisterous tune in River of Dreams, and we feel like it's going to be taken away from us. So it's better to not believe in anything at all. Because what if that thing you cling to turns out to be something that's horrible or worse yet boring? So we can't live without the truth. And yet, it scares us. But with the scars, The scars say that truth isn't a proposition, it's a person. And he's one that doesn't end around life's hardness, but goes in and through them. See, when you stop, the verbs in the text are like, he's almost like he's saying to Thomas, stop being unbelieving, be believing. Look at the scars. He's saying, look, the same shame, the same guilt, the same pain, the same woundedness that you and everyone have been through, I've shared in it because I'm as fragile as you, and yet you know I'm not just anybody else. And because of the precious power of the scars, everything can really be different because you don't have to end around your pain, and yet you don't have to take it with the kind of seriousness that makes it despairing. You can actually think it can be healed. And then you can go show somebody the scars and have them unbind their wounds. There's a great poem, which I see as a sort of almost response to River of Dreams. It's called Jesus of the Scars. If we have never sought, we seek thee now. Thine eyes burn through the dark, our only stars. We must have sight of thorn pricks on thy brow. We must have thee, O Jesus of the Scars. The heavens frighten us, they are too calm. In all the universe we have no place. Our wounds are hurting us, where is the balm? Lord Jesus, by thy scars we claim thy grace. If when the doors are shut thou drawest near, only reveal those hands, that side of thine. We know today what wounds are, have no fear, show us thy scars. We know the countersign. The other gods were strong, but thou wast weak. They rode, but thou didst stumble to a throne. But to our wounds, only God's wounds speak. And not a God who has wounds, but thou alone. Chesterton once wrote that when a soldier is ambushed, if he's going to survive, he's got to yearn for water, life like water. But he's got to be able to drink death like wine. See, that's where the power of the scars are. In the midst of life's seas and travesties, in the midst of the seas and tragedies that threaten to capsize the fragile little ship, we can love life like water and celebrate it, and yet be able to look at the dark stuff like fine wine, because he's the one who is weak, and yet in weakness unleashed the supreme life-giving power in the world. Amen.